like, I really feel like it was probably 10 years in before I realized, oh, this is like math. You know, like, this is like, you have to, like, there's a formula here that you have to really work out in the ways. And when I started seeing other comedians, like, oh, I see it now. I see the lines, like a beautiful mind.
It's How to Be Amazing. I'm Michael Ian Black. I was trying to think about how to describe my guest today. And in doing so, I was trying to think of somebody else who does what he does. And the closest person I could think of is Dick Gregory, who is he's still alive. He's in his 80s. But he was a comedian and an activist, or an activist and a comedian. He's somebody whose comedy and activism became so entwined that it became impossible to separate the two.
I mean, now don't get me wrong. I wouldn't mind paying my income tax if I knew it was going to a friendly country. And we have a lot of racial prejudice up north, but we're so clever with it. Take my hometown, Chicago. I mean, you can't see it just going in there. When Negroes in Chicago move into one large area and it looks like we might control the votes, they don't say anything to us. They have a slum clearance.
So what Dick Gregory was doing in the 60s and 70s, I think W. Kamau Bell is doing today. His television show on CNN, The United Shades of America, explores different American cultures and identities. And that's the same theme from his previous show, Totally Biased. That theme informs his several comedy albums, his multiple podcasts, and now his new book entitled The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, Tales of a 6'4" African-American, heterosexual, cisgender, left-leaning, asthmatic, black, and proud blurred mama's boy, dad, and stand-up comedian, W. Kamau Bell. Welcome
you.
To How to Be Amazing.
Thank you, Michael. That was amazing. I'm with the Dick Gregory. That's high praise.
That's cool, right?
Yeah. Also, that means I'll be working until I'm 80, so that's good. I opened for him twice. It was quite a thing.
Really?
Yeah, at Caroline's here in New York City.
Now, when Dick Gregory performs now, he's mm-hmm. in his 80s,
mm-hmm.
who's in the audience?
For him, it's young people in their 60s. like it's really a funny, like, you know, it's definitely an older crowd. It's the old school civil rights crowd that is like, they were young when MLK was around.
Right.
And now they're professionals, black professional people who still go to church every Sunday.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And when you opened for Dick Gregory, how does W. Kamau Bell go over for that crowd?
Even though I was probably 35, I went over like I was who's this 18-year-old up here? I come off like a young whippersnapper. I think he even called, give the young man, you know, I'm married, man. paying rent. So it comes off. I don't know that Dick Gregory has any memory of me opening for him, because he's you know, there's comics who are in their zone, and if you're Dick Gregory, you've seen everything. The deeper he gets into a set, the more you're like, this dude's a comic.
Mm-hmm.
He's got jokes. You know, like, it's like you sort of, it's like you sort of forget that he's like this, he's got jokes about marriage, you know what I mean? About his kids being dumb, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, there is the stuff where it's like chemtrails and the CIA is poisoning the water, you know, yes, he's all for that. But then he's just got like, that's the thing I was so amazed by, this guy's got jokes.
Did you always have that? Did you always have that sense of knowing how to work to the funny or not?
No, I was definitely, as a kid, I was just sort of like, you know, situationally funny. Like, I was funny with my friends, my good friends and my family, but I was not like out there working the bits. I think that's why it took me so long to figure it out. Like, I had to figure out, oh, you have to write jokes. You can't just talk. You can't just yammer. Like, I really feel like it was probably 10 years in before I realized, oh, this is like math. You know, like, this is like, you have to, like, there's a formula here that you have to really work out in the ways. And when I started seeing other comedians, like, oh, I see it now. I see the lines, like a beautiful mind.
Your stand-up background is in the Bay Area, San Francisco.
Yeah.
And you talk a lot about how for 4, 5, 6, 7 years, you just weren't very good.
Yeah.
And it made me think, why is he still doing this? 7 years in.
Did my dad send that question in? he was certainly asking that question.
Did you know that there was a good stand-up comedian in you that hadn't come out, or was it just your love of the game was so strong that you're like, this is what I do?
Oh, no, I didn't love the game. I hated the game. Mm-hmm. I hated all of the game. I hated going on, hated doing on the road. I hated doing one-nighters. I hated, like...
So you hated doing it, and you weren't that good at it. You're like, this is the life for me.
This is the life for me. The thing, all you can say is there was something inside of me that said, I believe, not that I know, I think no is a different thing. I think you have to have evidence for no. I believe that there is a good stand-up comedian in me. And when I started, let me be clear, I sort of had this idea at an open mic. I actually really started in Chicago, but there was no scene there at the time. It was in the boom had crashed and the clubs were closing.
So this is like the mid-90s.
Mid-90s, yeah.
Stand-up was dead.
Stand-up was dead, and there's no alt scene, especially right. Not in Chicago, like maybe New York and L.A., but there was no... Me and my friends were the alt scene, and nobody was going to see stand-up comedy. Def Jam was big, so I'd see black comedy. I'd be like, oh, and I'd go try to look at it. I can't do that. And so... I was like, but I thought, just because I was like, I like doing comedy. We're all me and my friends are all kind of funny. I thought, like, I had this, like, I remember thinking 3 years I should be probably, you know, out in L.A. doing something. Just like, you know.
3 years I should probably have my own show.
I'll be in the mix. You know, I really thought I'd be in the mix somehow. You know, movies, TV, you know, whatever comes. Whatever me and my team of agents decide. And then the third year in Chicago, I realized it's basically like I'd been held back a year. I was like, I did the second year again. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't get any better. Nothing. I don't have more gigs. I don't have more respect. I don't have more press. I have nothing to show from this year, and so that's when I moved to the Bay Area because I was like, I gotta start over. And I'd read books about the comedy. I'm the guy. I was a comedy nerd before we knew that was a thing.
Right.
And the San Francisco scene was always referenced as being like where you could get better, not where you got famous, where you got better.
And did you find that to be the case when you went there?
Yes, I did. Yeah, because the thing about the San Francisco scene, and people in San Francisco don't really respect this. That there is a path to sort of getting to the stage. Like if you go to the Punchline, when I started, it was 6 months. Just come to the club every Sunday for 6 months. We'll eventually put you on stage.
So there's an open mic at the Punchline, which is a famous San Francisco club.
Yeah.
And every Sunday you would just show up and do your, what, 3, 4, 5 minutes?
You'd show up you'd hope to get on. And they would sort of basically see, do you have the stamina to wait 6 months?
Oh, so you're not even getting on.
No.
You're just that kid sitting in the audience.
No, you're in the, there's like the, you're in the back. They let the comics come into the back of the club.
Uh-huh.
Some nights there's more comics than audience. You know, some nights... You'd get bumped because, you know, somebody would come in. Like, you get graded on attendance. You're tipping the wait staff. You're not being a jerk. It's like a whole, like, I try to tell you, it's a job interview.
It's a six-month job interview.
If you are, like, rude to the bar staff at the Punchline, you better be really funny. Uh-huh. Like, because they're not going to, you can be not that funny and nice to everybody and get on.
What was it, do you think, that was creatively holding you back in those years?
I had jokes that were funny. It wasn't that the jokes were, I mean, so, you know, there were some were bad, but, you know, I had jokes. I could open. I could do 20 minutes. But there was nothing, there was no through line. Like, I had jokes about race and racism. Then I had jokes about how men's magazines and women's magazines are different. Am I right? You know, just sort of like, you'd have these jokes where, like, what is that joke doing next to this joke?
Mm-hmm.
There was a light point of view, but there wasn't a strong point of view.
So you're 10 years, 12 years in, or I mean, I don't know, you're 20 years in now or however long.
Yeah, yeah.
What would you describe as the W. Kamau Bell point of view that you have found?
You know, I find that it's generally comes from a place. I mean, there's definitely a lot of race stuff, but it generally comes from a place of like seeing. I mean, you know, when you get all, you're a comic, we're comics, but I'm still aware of like people listening, like you get all high minded. But I think like as comedians, we have to sort of let that go because jazz people get high minded, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that I know that it comes from a place of like frustration about the world not living up to its promise. Now, most times it's through racism, but then what I learned in the Bay Area is that I have to connect that through, I have to be more inclusive about my standpoint, about my viewpoint. So it can be about, you know, so then it becomes about like homophobia or becomes about transphobia. And then the other thing that my act is like also making it clear to the audience, I don't always have the answers.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a problem. So it's like, I can't just go on stage, you know, like Bill Hicks is probably my favorite comedian. I can't be like Bill Hicks and always be like, here's the truth. Like, I can't, that doesn't work for me. I can be like, here's what I think. And then sometimes I can lean into that, but I can't. It's okay to write a joke from a place of like, I'm not sure.
And now we down to the two choices, you know, Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama. That's going to be a hard choice for America. That's going to be a hard choice for America because it's a Mormon versus a black guy. And a lot of America doesn't like either one of those things. Like Mormon versus black guy. It's like aliens versus predator. what am I gonna do? It's something I hate versus something I don't understand.
When you say a frustration at the world for not living up to its promise, do you have a sense of what that promise is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a kid, you know, I was born in 73, so this is post the civil rights era, and I sort of grew up in the first post-racial America. Like, MLK had, like, marched on Washington, and he was, sure, he was assassinated, but racism was basically over. Like, it was like, you know, like, I mean, it didn't end well, but at that point, we all understood that, you know, I sort of grew up in a racism is over, everything's fine. And although I lived in a house where my mom was always talking about it, and there was, you know, there's always conversations about it, it felt like something from the past. And so for me, I grew up thinking like, oh, I can do whatever I want to do, say whatever I want to say. And then as I become a teenager, sort of starting to feel a disconnect of like, that's not actually true. And then as an adult looking around, go, that's not true for most people. So I think there's this idea of America that we are sold, as, especially as kids, you know, that the land of opportunity, the promise of, you know, you can do whatever you want to be, you can be president, all those things. And then as you move through this world, you know, that's not true for everybody. And then after I have kids, I'm like, oh, shit. Like, I have to try to make sure it's good. That's true for them. Because they believe they can be anything right now because they're 6 and 2.5, you know. And I kind of would like it if they could always believe that.
The hesitancy you're hearing in my voice right now is trying to understand how to get deeper into this conversation. So let me just start by responding with what you just said, which is that the promise of America is that you can grow up and be anything you want to be. Mm-hmm. W. Kamau Bell, at a certain age, a young age, said, I want to be a comedian. Mm-hmm. And now you're a comedian. And, yeah. And at some point you said, I want to, presumably, in the back of your mind, you're like, I want to have a TV show. You've had a couple TV shows.
Yeah, you don't accidentally get TV shows.
So what is it about you that separates you from the kind of hypothetical people that you're talking about whose promise cannot be fulfilled?
Why do I get to be here and other people can't be here? Is that the question?
I guess some version of that. Version of that, because the premise of what you're saying to me is the American dream is a lie. You cannot
for
get
many, for many
for
of
many
us.
For many yeah
or
for,
it's a or it's a lottery ticket that you have a very small chance of winning. It's
right.
Not that you can't. It's not that you can't do things, but then the chances are different for depending on who you are and where you come from.
And I would also say, just not having the additional burden of race hampering me, just the idea of going into show business, I felt like that. Like, yeah. it's a lottery ticket.
Yeah, yeah.
And so here you and I are two lottery winners, essentially.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it has worked out for me to the extent that it has worked out for me is because I very quickly learned I can't pursue traditional pathways.
Hmm.
The thing that changed my career was leaving the clubs. The success that I wanted, I had to sort of let go of the idea because at that point I was still like, well, you know, I went to Montreal on New Faces. I was that guy who went and thought, oh, yeah, I'll go to New Faces, da-da-da.
New Faces is this showcase at the Montreal Comedy Festival where new faces come and hope to make a splash and hope to leave Montreal with a big deal and agents.
It's literally
and
you're supposed to be a big break. I mean, that's how it's kind of sold to you, even though people who have been to Montreal for New Faces go, it's not your big break, relax. And you go, no, but it'll be mine. It will be mine. You know, and back in the day, when the boom was happening, comics would come out with like representation management and a development deal.
Right.
Then at some point it just came out with representation and management. Well, I went in without representation and management and then came out without representation and management. This is in 2005. So at that point I'm 11 years in.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of passed through as if nothing, like, you know, like kale through a colon, just like nothing happened. And then I did Premium Blend on Comedy Central, thought, okay, well, that's fine. I would do Premium Blend. I had a good set on Premium Blend.
That's why I hope the black leader we get is Barack Obama, the black senator from Illinois. Yeah. Yeah. That dude is cool. People say he's going to be president someday. My question is, president of what? Because one day there may be a black president, but there will never be a black president named Barack Obama. Ladies and gentlemen, that's too black. That dude's name might as well be Blackie Blackerson. See what I'm saying?
At that point, I was told it was the first Obama joke I ever told in 2005. I'm like, all right, well, with the knowledge of that, I am just going to be... And then suddenly you're like, you know, still, that's, you know, I'm still sort of waiting for the next thing or somebody's going to call me and bobbling some things where you get some opportunities. And then you're like, okay, I don't have it in me. Being honest about myself is, I think, why I made it. I don't have it in me to move to L.A. I don't have it. It's just not. I can't move to L.A. and just start auditioning for stuff. I don't really want to be an actor. I know when I don't want to do things, I'm really not good at them. I'm not like that. I won't be motivated to do a good job. And then sort of realizing that, okay, I'm featuring at the clubs now and doing like off-night headlining, realizing that's a dead-end road, like being like an in-town headliner. And then like took a trip to Okinawa with my friend Kevin Avery, who hosts my Denzel podcast with me. And being in Okinawa, performing on military bases for like 18 and 20 year old dudes who just like would have preferred strippers. Mm-hmm. And just going, is this my life? Is this what I do? I'm just like a random, like a magician, a hypnotist, like that kind of comic. And coming back from Okinawa and be like, I can't do this for a living. I was a big time thinking about quitting at that point in my career. My friends were every 2 weeks, I think I might quit. But not being able to, like physically not being able to leave it behind. And then basically made a decision to go to a black box theater in San Francisco and write my own show. I had to sort of let go of whatever I think success is and just go for creative success. The thing I did when I wrote my solo show, it was called The Debbie Kamau Bell Curve, Any Racism in About an Hour. The thought I literally put in my head was like, what would you do if you were famous? Like, what kind of work would you be doing? Like, if you just had the ability to do whatever you wanted to. And I was like, I would have a show where I talked about race and racism, and I would have like videos and slides and PowerPoint and the thing. And I didn't even know how to do that stuff. But I was like, basically, I was like, I would have my version of The Daily Show.
Black people, we are so much a part of America's pop culture. I mean, I looked it up on the internet. You know how much of America's pop culture we're responsible for? All of it. Rock and roll, the jazz, blues, R&B, gospel, pop, soul, hip-hop. We invented all of America's popular music without fail. Did I miss anything? What? Reggae's not American. What? Country? Country? Yes, we invented country. And I can prove it mathematically. Country music equals the blues minus slavery.
When you got your show Totally Biased, mm-hmm. Which was your first television show on FX, that came about as a result of Chris Rock seeing you. Is that correct?
Yeah, he saw the bell curve. He saw it like after it was like, I knew what it was. I'd been doing it around the country. I'd done it at festivals, done it at fringe festivals. And I did it at UCB Theater here in New York City and didn't know he was there. Thank you, Black Jesus. I'm really happy that I didn't know he was there. I knew that there was like somebody told me that he was sort of thinking about me and he liked me. At that point, I was like, maybe I can open for him someday. But mm-hmm. He was just in the back of the room. And afterwards, he came back and told me he thought I was funny. And I, you know, and then called me and basically insisted that he helped me get a TV show.
Did he then mentor you and shepherd you into that process?
Yeah, he was an EP on the show. Me and the guy who ended up being the showrunner produced like a San Francisco pilot. Chris saw it and said, okay, let me put some money on this. So Chris put his own money in that he didn't know he was going to get back. Chris basically hand-delivered that to John Landgraf at FX. He's like, I'm going to have John, and Chris Rock talks like this, I'm going to have lunch with John Landgraf. He's probably going to give us a deal. So just be prepared for a phone call. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You haven't even met the man. You know, like, it's just like.
I've never had that conversation with anybody where somebody's like, yeah, I'm going to go have lunch with somebody. Your phone's going to ring. You're going to have a deal. I've never had that conversation.
I mean, I went to the first meeting with John Landgraf, like still like, is this really happening? And the first thing he said is like, I feel like we're married, but we haven't met yet. And it was just like, oh, okay. And so John Landgraf he's known for this. He takes big swings. He takes chances. They clearly don't all pan out. But Chris, like, just knew. And also, Chris's confidence will light rooms up. I've seen it happen.
Welcome to Totally Biased, everybody. I'm Debbie Kamau Bell. Thank you. Thank you. This week, our guest is the amazing Academy Award-nominated actor Don Cheadle. Get over Don Cheadle. I got excited. I got a little Oprah there for a second. Don Cheadle!
With Totally Biased, you just sort of chuckled, as you said. He takes big swings, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And it was clear that you were being self-deprecating about your own show.
Yeah.
Because it did last for, what, a year and a half?
We went like a year and a couple months.
Right.
Yeah.
What went wrong?
I wasn't ready. like when I see John Oliver, how he went from being a correspondent on The Daily Show to guest hosting for 6 weeks to Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, that's the path. Or Samantha Bee, mm-hmm. to go from like being one of the longest tenured Daily Show correspondents to her show, that's the path. You know, the thing that I'd avoided was Hollywood. Was probably something that I could have used. I didn't know how to do the things. I didn't know what any of the jobs were. What's the difference between a second producer and a show producer and a floor producer and what who can I ask to get my coffee and who is that insulting? Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, and I was an EP and the star of the show and sort of like being in meetings about budgets and things sometimes, like, is that a lot of money? You know, mm-hmm. like the time I spent on the show, like I've worked on it for like 2 years, was like getting an associate's degree in TV from Chris Rock University. And I just was totally green. Like, you can see it on camera. I was just like, you know, prompter's not an easy thing. And mm-hmm. and I was also like having to read other people's jokes in prompter. And sometimes I'd be like, I don't even understand what the punchline is here. But we're taping the show right now, so I better land the end of this sentence as if I know what the punchline is. And also, I had a lot of friends who I hired on the show, and being your friend's boss is hard. Being your one friend's boss is hard. Being the boss to multiple of your friends who 6 months before, you're all in the same level.
Right.
So some of those people I came through being stronger friends with after the show, and some I haven't talked to since.
Although the show did not get the ratings that obviously FX and you had been hoping for.
I think Deadline called them historically low.
But historically anyway. Low.
I only read the article once because it was quite painful.
I've been there. You did receive a lot of accolades for the show. I think specifically for the kind of inclusiveness of the show. You gave a lot of people who maybe didn't have a voice, you literally gave them a voice.
Hey, Representative Todd Akin, I have a question for you. If women can't get pregnant from legitimate rape, then how come there's so many light-skinned black people walking around Alabama? This is totally biased.
When W. Kamau Bell started out, he expected great things for his career. He figured, 2 years of toil, then he'd be a big star, he'd have a team of agents. Then, 8 years later, he finds himself still stacking chairs in comedy clubs waiting for his big break. What changed? He realized, eventually, that the path to success lay in being himself. Does that sound familiar? It should, listeners, because that is a recurring theme on this show. Coming up, we're talking more about how W. Kamau Bell learned to be himself, and we talk about his new show on CNN, where he uses comedy as a way to start pretty important conversations about race and culture. So FX was not, as it turned out, the right home. Now you're on CNN.
Yeah.
Which I look at that and I go, that doesn't seem like the right home, but it's working.
No, it does. You know, I've joked and I've seen this probably tired of me saying this. Like, no comic grows up saying, one day I hope to have a show on CNN. I mean, maybe now they do because of me, but like, that's not... You know, I went like so Totally Wise gets canceled. I legitimately think my career is over because a lot of times that happens to people who are like sort of come out of nowhere and then disappears that you sort of go, well, what happened to that guy? I felt embarrassed about the fact that the show was canceled. Still, you know, wife gets pregnant with her second kid and I don't know what to do, but I start taking meetings and all the meetings are with news organizations or news websites. Like, it's all very newsy. And I just wish I thought was interesting because it was like everybody sort of realized they needed comedy content. And CNN, I had a general meeting at CNN, and they were like, well, we're not doing a late night talk show. Like, just sort of to let me know, I was like, well, thank God, because I'm not doing a late night talk show. Mm-hmm. At the time, forget CNN as a news network, I was a fan of Bourdain. I was a fan of Morgan Spurlock. I was a fan of Mike Rowe's show, Dirty Jobs. Lisa Ling was there. They had started to put on these original series shows that I liked all those people. They just happened to be at CNN. And so I'm like, well, if I like those people and those shows are doing well, I feel like I could be another one of those shows.
We're here to talk about white privilege. We want to bring it back. Make white privilege great again.
So you're a fan of white privilege?
Oh, yeah.
What do you love about white privilege?
Oh, it looks great. Like, you know, I mean, the people are good looking and, you know, nice suits, great literature. Like, yeah, I just want to bathe in white privilege, the greatest, most awesome thing.
It's working out for you.
We hired less white men this year. We think that it's inherently wonderful for white people to have less power. Oh, that's great. Oh, I'm glad. I hope the new James Bond is going to be a black guy. That would be great for the world.
Is that a real big deal, though, if James Bond's a black guy? Is that really, like, do you
care?
Well,
for me, that might be it.
That's too much?
It's too much.
I mean,
the first episode of the second season, the through line was immigration, and it featured the founder of the term alt-right, Richard Spencer, who has now become, I would say, America's foremost white supremacist.
He wouldn't describe himself that way, but yes, I appreciate the fact that people do. He is a white supremacist.
Well, he is.
Yeah.
Do you ever worry that sitting down with a Richard Spencer, do you worry about giving somebody like that the platform that they're clearly craving?
Yeah. There's two words that I think we are being overused right now. No offense. Platform and normalizing.
Like, I didn't say normalizing.
I know you didn't. That's why I'm still talking to you. If you said normalizing.
That's my next question. Shit, I got to.
You better scratch that out. Which to me sometimes is a legit question and sometimes is a way of saying I want to avoid a hard conversation.
But is it a hard conversation? Because you're not going to have a conversation with Richard Spencer. That's not a conversation in the sense that either of you are going to walk away from that changed in any way, shape, or form.
Well, okay. I think it depends on how you define change to get off of Bill Clinton-y. Uh-huh. Like he went in, he sat down at the table smiling. He walked up, he left the table going, I'm horrified. Like, you know, so by just the nature of what I said at the end of the conversation. So for me, am I changing his mind? No. But is this it's not like me and Richard Spencer met in a bar and had a conversation.
Right.
I was doing this for the sake of television. And I know, and this is the other thing I think, not everybody is as woke as we all think we are. And a lot of us think that, like, if I know who Richard Spencer is and I know his ideas are heinous, then everybody does. And the fact is, that's not true. I mean, I know from last year when I met with the Ku Klux Klan, there was black people who were like, how could you put the Ku Klux Klan on TV and normalize these idiots? Okay, fair enough. Then I get all these white people, oh my God, I had no idea the Ku Klux Klan still existed. Well, then that's who the show is for. And I know from watching last night that many white people who like to sort of turn a blind eye to that, or black people of all races like to turn a blind eye and sort of know that Richard Spencer was out there, but really haven't looked it in the face, actually looked it in the face last night. And when you put in the context of also telling very beautiful, heartwarming, inspiring stories of other refugees, then you go, how can these two things exist in the same country? If it wasn't an hour-long interview with Richard Spencer.
Right.
The Richard Spencer interview was specifically used as a way to put heat under the conversation about, you know, we talked to a Syrian refugee who'd been in the country for a month and a half, who just wants, like, had to escape Syria because a lot of things we did at this country, and it just needs a job and a place to stay, and is trying to provide for his family. Why would we want to turn that guy away? Okay, that's one question. But then we have this guy, Richard Spencer, who's like, America is for whites only. And his ideas are in the White House. This is not just a conversation between me and Richard Spencer. This is a conversation America needs to have with itself.
Named in October 2013, a American Civil Liberties Union Celebrity Ambassador of Racial Justice, which is a profound title.
Yeah.
But what does racial justice look like to you?
You know, true racial justice means America actually confronts the systems of institutionalized and structural racism that exist in the fabric of this country from the very bottom to the very top. From the very bottom means, like, the next episode of United Shades of America is about Chicago and gang violence. But what it really becomes about is, like, how come there's no jobs and not good schools on the south and west side of Chicago? There's acres of open land on the south side of Chicago and the west. There's acres. Like,
you're saying there's room for a school. You could put a school.
You could put a school. You could put a grocery store. Yeah, exactly. It's not like Manhattan. Where are we going to build a school? There's acres of open, abandoned land that if the city of Chicago gave companies tax incentives and tax breaks and then also reconceived how the police work in Chicago so they were actually protecting the good people of the neighborhoods from the bad people from the neighborhoods, that the West Side and South Chicago would come back very quickly. But because we've put this label of gang violence, it's the gang violence that makes it bad. No, it's the lack of resources that make it bad. And then people turn to things they shouldn't turn to, like drugs and violence. So that's the low end. On the high end, it becomes about like really this country going, okay, what can we do to eliminate racism from the structures of this country? You know, when you look at the picture of Obama's cabinet and all the people who he worked with, that looked like America to me. When you look at the picture of Donald Trump's cabinet, that does not look like America. It looks like a Fortune 500 boardroom with a couple of token women in it. And then you look at like the prison system in this country. It's that first season we did an episode about the prison system, and it's like, you know, black people are like 12% of the population, but 40% of the prison system. And people go, well, black people need to stop stealing. No, slow down. We're over-sentenced for crimes we do, and we're also often in jail for crimes we didn't do. That's racial justice.
You've got I think a really kind of brilliant analogy on your album, Semi-Prominent Negro, where you talk about how when a black person says that was racism, and then a white person says, well, how do you know that was racism, that incident?
Yeah.
And let me just explain, white people, this is what it sounds like when you say that to us, because I don't think you get how crazy that sounds. It would be like if I was to run into you on the street, collective white person. And I was like, hey, what do you do today? I was like, well, I got up, I ran some errands, and I had lunch. What'd you have for lunch? I had pizza. How'd you know it was pizza? You'd be like, what are you talking about? Because I knew it was pizza. It was clearly said pizza. I have pizza almost every day. That's what I think is suspicious. How are you having all this pizza every day? Because there's pizza everywhere in the world. No, I don't see all this pizza you're seeing. I don't think you had pizza. Are you sure it wasn't pita bread with cheese on it? Are you sure it wasn't pita bread with cheese on it? No, it was pizza. I've eaten a lot of pizza in my life. My parents ate a lot of pizza. My grandparents ate a lot of pizza. My great-grandparents, my great-great-great-grandparents were brought to this country to make pizza, but they weren't allowed to eat it, weirdly. I know it was goddamn pizza. I don't know. Let me ask somebody else who's never had pizza. Come here. You've never had pizza. Do you think that? I don't think it was pizza. He's always talking about pizza. Now I have to kill you.
It seems like you can't even begin to have the conversation until you have that acknowledgement that the experience is real.
Yeah.
As a black guy in America, just 500 years in, and they're still not acknowledging the experience.
Yeah.
At some point, it seems like your mind would explode.
Well, and a lot of black people's minds do explode. A lot of black people walk around feeling like they're crazy. And that's why a lot of black people, like I live in the Bay Area, and there's black people in Oakland, like, who are black people who are walking around next to you, like, we need to get these white folks. You know what I mean? Like, who are just have gotten to the point of, like, you know, like, who, yeah, they smile at you at Starbucks. They, you know, they hold the door open for you, but they are seething with anger about the system. And when I talk to those black people, and they also like the fact I'm married to a white woman, and when I talk to those black people, I'm not like, I don't understand where that coming from. No, I get it. It's driven you crazy. Like, you know, and at some point I may need you to get my back because I don't know what's gonna happen to me either. So like, I'm not gonna, you know, discount you. It makes you feel like you're crazy. And I think that the other thing is too, is that you, and I talk about this on the album too, I think, is that you don't even tell your black friends or your friends of color about all the racist things that happened, because you'd be talking about things that happened all day, or things you thought were racist, or things you're like, I felt like that might have been, you know what I mean? And it just
so becomes... does racism itself inform your relationships with other black people?
Oh, of course.
In what way?
Even in the sense of like knowing that any random black person I run into the street, if something racist happens to me and I run into any random black person, I'm like, hey, brother, can I talk to you for a second? That you have that access to that conversation. There's times when things happen where something will happen, and I'll look around at another black person and be like, do you believe these white folks? I don't believe you. That you have that connection. It's the same. It's the thing that happens, you know, and it's funny, you hear it's like a stock joke that comics do now, but like literally my wife goes, did you know that black guy you just nodded at? No, I didn't know that black dude I just nodded at.
You mentioned your wife who's white, and there was a incident that you talk about on an episode of This American Life called Birds and Bees. It involves a racist incident that happened to you at a Berkeley cafe.
So I get to the Elmwood Cafe, and I see my wife sitting at one of their sidewalk tables with our baby and three other moms and their babies. The four moms all look like they would go out for the same casting call. For a white woman, mid-30s,
who has recently had a kid and, while exhausted, is doing a great job of keeping it together. My wife introduced me to the group. We made small talk. One of the women asked about the book in my hand, so I turned it over and showed it to her. She nodded at the cover. I didn't get the sense she knew the story. That's when I heard, knock, knock, knock. It was on the cafe's window, coming from inside. I looked up and saw a woman, a server, who clearly worked at the Elmwood Cafe, and she was angry and looking at me. Next, she flicked her head and mouthed something. I didn't know what, but the message was clear. Get! Or maybe it was, scram! Seriously, what's the difference? I was flooded with thoughts I could barely process. I was stunned. I was pissed. I wanted to run away. I felt like I might pass out. I was actually strangely embarrassed, as if I had done something wrong. Maybe I shouldn't have been talking to my wife and her friends.
Later in that piece, you interview a guy who says something that seems to really resonate with you. He says, don't let anything go. He's gotten to a point in his life as a black man where he does not let anything go. And then simultaneously, you've said that you sometimes think you have too much anger. Mm-hmm. How, on a daily basis, are you able to navigate the world without letting anything go and walking that line between having too much anger and just being able to breathe and exist?
It's like water. It's like boiling water in a kettle. That, like, it's like when you have the kettle that makes the whistle noise when it's ready, you have to be able to let that whistle noise out sometimes. Like, like sometimes it's literally like, did you just see that? I mean, it's the comedy is about letting that stuff go. And sometimes it means I go, I'm going to talk about you on stage. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like in the moment, sort of, the comedy's given me the ability to be more direct about these things in the moment and sort of not be afraid of, like, the consequences sometimes. So it's literally about, like, I say, the thing I talk about now is, like, I put it back on the person. Sometimes racism gives you a problem that you didn't mean, that you aren't supposed to have, and the person gets to walk away like they didn't do. Like, white people are like, here, take some racism with you. Oh, damn it. And now I'm like, hot potato, like, I'm throwing it back at you. So, like, there's been times where it's like, I'm throwing it right back at you, so you have to tell the story tonight of, like, this thing happened, as opposed to me telling the story about this thing happened. So to me, it's about, like, not swallowing it all the time. And especially it's important as I have kids. I don't want my kids to see me swallow it all the time. I want my kids to tell the story about the crazy thing dad said to the person, as opposed to, like, that somebody did something I didn't understand it and dad was sad the rest of the day. Especially having two girls of color, speak up. Don't be afraid to say something. So it's really important now. But that's why the Elmwood Cafe thing became a public forum, because this thing happens at the cafe. The cafe sees me talking to my wife and my white-looking 13-week-old baby and a bunch of other white moms and their white-looking babies. One of the other babies was mixed, too. And I talked to him for 2 minutes, and somebody in the cafe knocks on the window and tells me to leave because they think I'm harassing the women. If that had just happened to me, I probably would have just swallowed it or told a story about a joke about it on stage. But because it happened to my family, me and my wife are like, we got to do something about this. My daughter's 13 weeks old. I just don't want her to take that in, that, like, her family lays down to racism. So I was like, so it became a public forum. We made a big thing about it and tried to turn it into an event and tried to get the community to come out for it.
And it's worth noting, this is happening in Berkeley.
Yeah.
The leftiest of left cities.
Yeah.
It's also worth noting that public forum, I think it sold out.
We didn't sell tickets, but it was standing room only.
Right. I don't know how else to.
Yeah. We made a lot of money. We sold T-shirts. The merch table was cleaned out.
It was full. Yeah. Also,
and the media showed up. We had all the local media trucks there. It was it turned into a Bay Area event.
But also, I just want to tie this into something larger. Your show, you said that your first one-man show, the W. Kamau Bell Curve, How to Solve Racism in Under an Hour. Also, you said you didn't draw as a name, but that drew.
Yeah.
And what it says to me, and what I sort of instinctively believe, is that America, the nation, is not only hungry, but starving for this conversation. Starving to have what I think is the fundamental conversation about America. Mm-hmm. And yet, for however long, for the entirety of our history, we haven't had it. Do you have any idea of what that conversation would look like? What it would be?
I mean, I think we'd have to realize it can't be just one conversation, and I think we have to realize there's got to be multiple levels of the conversation. I think comedians are able to have it more often. I don't think it's an accident that many times America's so-called funniest comedians are black comedians talking about racism. Like, you know, like whether it's Richard Pryor or, you know, Chappelle and Chris Rock pass the baton back and forth. What I try to do is not only have the conversation in comedy, is be a conduit to, like, and now go talk to Alicia Garza from Black Lives Matter. Now go talk to Rosa Clemente from the Green Party. Like, try it, which is what I'm doing through the podcast and through the show, is like, I'm the last, ha, 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 now go sign up for this petition. You know, like, you know, go sign up, go talk to Color of Change, go talk to Color Lines, go talk to the ACLU. For me, it becomes more important than just having the jokes, is to actually sort of push people into the change.
That is where I think you cross the line into Dick Gregory territory, which is this idea of activism, this idea of moving comedy into the realm of doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, stand-up comedy is a uniquely American art form. They do it in other countries, but it's definitely started here. And the modern era of stand-up comedy is about the highest level of the art form, if you name those names, is people who are talking about America's problems. Lenny Bruce, Joan Rivers, you know, George Carlin. I think it's not an accident that the people included as among the highest practitioners of the art form, the people who stand the test of time, not people who are big for a couple of years, but the people who we put on that Mount Rushmore are people who are talking directly to America about America's problems.
Now the book is out. You've written a book about a lot of these same topics.
Yeah.
The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell tells of a 6'4" African-American, heterosexual, cisgender, left-leaning, asthmatic, black and proud, blurred, which is black nerd, mama's boy, dad, and stand-up comedian. Just touching on the
even
black...
Even that title, just real quick, I've had many friends of mine go, that's great, I love it. I had to Google cisgender. Like, for me, I'm like, mission accomplished. Like, just the fact that they had to go, let me look that one word up. And some people had to look up blurred, but yeah, it just feels
Oh,
like...
I didn't know... That word, actually, I have a question about, which is, you talk about growing up as a kid, and your favorite superheroes were Spider-Man and the Hulk. And you talk about how one of the things you liked about them was that in their heroic forms as the Hulk, as Spider-Man, they were raceless or...
Yeah.
But at the same time, there were black superheroes, but you didn't identify with them as strongly. So even as a kid... Were you maybe subconsciously looking for the erasure of race as a governing force in your life?
As a kid, I thought the erasure of race as a governing force in my life had happened. Because again, I think I grew up in the first, we didn't call it post-racial, but post-civil rights movement, where we're like, we're all the same, we're all equal, have a coke and a smile. You know, I'd like to teach the world to sing. You know, then you go into the 80s, you know, the biggest stars in the world are Oprah Winfrey, Michael Jordan, the artist formerly known as Bill Cosby. Like, these are the biggest stars in the world, and they're everywhere. So you think like, oh, it's all the way. I'm like, in 1984, I was 11. So I was like, look at that. So I thought on some level that I had access to things that I didn't have access to. And then to sort of by the time you become a teenager as a black man in America, and I was tall, suddenly like your experience of the world around you changes because the world starts treating you very differently.
Because the world perceives you as a threat?
The world perceives you as, the world always perceives black boys, especially in teen years, as being older than they are. And it's because they think they think you're a man. And the world perceives you as either you are doing something criminal now, even if it's not now, you're probably going to do it later so I can treat you like you're doing something criminal now. And so for me, it was like, as a kid who likes superheroes, you also want to like the popular superheroes. You know what I mean? And so Spider-Man and the Hulk were popular and I liked them. And also, I think they both related to me. Spider-Man was like a kid and the Hulk was angry. And I was like, I'm a kid who's angry. So like, it felt like those two things.
Well, growing up in a post-racial America, the way you saw it, what were you angry about?
I moved around a lot. As a kid, a lot of it is like, moved around a lot. Did start to feel like I was not living up to the world's expectations of what I should be doing. Like, I was always a little bit outside of whatever what I felt like black mainstream culture was doing. I'm 44. I'm basically the exact same age as hip hop. So, and I listened to it sort of the way a suburban white woman listened to hip hop in the 80s. Like, I like that. I love that Rapper's Delight song. But I wasn't like buying the things. And, you know, like Dave Chappelle's the same age as me. And it's like, we have a lot of things. I feel like we have the same experiences. But a lot of times, like, yeah, he went deep in. And I was like watching reruns of The Incredible Hulk and, you know, and watching. You know,
was that conscious on your part, not going deep in?
No.
Would you have preferred if you could have gone deep in?
It would have made conversations easier. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day about, as a man, I know enough about sports to know what the big game is when it's happening, because it just makes conversations easier.
In the early 90s, when you were starting your comedy career, and you said early in the conversation, you would look at the deaf comedy comics.
Yeah.
Largely black comics performing for black audiences,
yeah,
going, I can't do that.
Yeah. And when I tried, I would sort of like, you know, me and Kevin Avery talk about this. He's a black dude who sort of has a similar experience. You start to curse more because you think that, like, suddenly your regular jokes, man, why aren't there no motherfucking black people on the motherfucking Flintstones? Like, what are you talking? I was at motherfucking Church's Fried Chicken. Like, what are you doing? And the audience is like, what are you doing? Just be yourself and bomb. Like, yeah, so.
So is, do you recognize that there's some irony in that audience that ended up embracing you as the Blurred is probably a predominantly white audience?
I mean, if you're going to make it in America in a big way, you're going to have a lot of white people. 80% of rap music is bought by white people,
right,
you know, despite what we think. So it is a white audience. Depending on where I am in the country, it's a there are a lot of white people in the audience. But it's also, there's a lot of black people. Like, the CNN show has helped in a big way.
Finish the conversation, I like to do something called the Amazing Five, where I will ask for a recommendation in each of five categories, one in each.
Okay.
We were just talking about music, so why don't you give me a music recommendation?
Oh, a music recommendation. This is something I discovered. It's not a new album. I'm more of a jazz fan than I think I realize or talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Branford Marsalis, who I was a fan. The Branford Marsalis Quartet has an album called Bragtown, which is from like 2006 that I just discovered recently. Thank you, Spotify. And I just started reading. I just listened to it because I happened to run into him when I was in New York this week.
Oh, shit. Name drop.
Yeah. I'm going to drop some names. Had never met him before. And I'd been randomly ran into him, met his son, and he's like, come meet my dad. Some guy says, oh my God, Kamau Bell, come meet my dad. I go, okay, guy, I'll go meet your dad. It's Branford Marsalis.
That's cool.
And his album Bragtown is a jazz album, and it's a very sort of straight ahead classic hard jazz album. It just makes me feel like my brain is expanding.
Books.
Okay, I feel like I recommend, I talk about this all the time. The Autobiography of Malcolm X. It's a super fun, easy read, ironically, and that I don't know if enough people have read it.
Can I tell you something about my experience with that book? First of all, I read it, and it really affected me profoundly. But it left me with a huge question that I haven't resolved. And I think probably a lot of white people
we'll
have
do
this
it right
question.
Here.
Great. Thank you, because no I need you on this.
Yeah.
I, as a white dude, read that book, and the message, the overriding message that I took away from it was, we as a people demand your respect and we don't need your help. We want to do this on our own. We want to do this from the ground up. We want to be self-sustaining,
mm-hmm,
empowered.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly don't want your hindrance,
mm-hmm,
but we don't need you.
Mm-hmm.
And as somebody, a young man who was reading black literature for the first time, I left that book going, is it better if I just don't? If I just take a step back, disengage is the wrong word,
mm-hmm,
but just not sort of scream from the rooftops, I'm an ally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an ally. I didn't know, and I still don't know how to resolve that question for myself.
It's funny. I think when you ask that, there's a point in the book, and it's in the movie Malcolm X too, where Malcolm X, this is in his, when he was still leading the Nation of Islam, so in his very sort of like almost black separatist days, well, black separatist, legitimately, and he's on a college campus and a young white woman comes up and says, what can I do to help support your movement? And he says, nothing, and he keeps moving. And every time I'm on a college campus and some white kid asks a very earnest question, I have nothing, but I don't say it, because I was like, that is so.
So I was right. I was like,
no, yeah, but I think that, and then later in the book, he says, I wish I'd answer that question differently. Mm-hmm. And my thing is that yes, you can be an ally, but the best way you can be an ally is by talking to your white people. Mm-hmm. Like, don't. I think sometimes white people come into black spaces and go, black people, a white person's
here.
Well,
man, who do you think this audience is? Food.
Go to Santung in San Francisco and have the dry fried chicken wings. They will
dry fried chicken wings. Oh wait, what was the name of it?
Santung.
Is that Korean?
It's funny. It's Korean Chinese food, but mm-hmm. I don't know. So yeah, it's funny that you picked that up. But apparently, it's Korean style Chinese food. But they're regularly on lists of the 100 things to eat in San Francisco before you die. It's in the Inner Sunset. I used to live there, and me and my wife used to just go there. And you know, it's the thing where you're like, should we get one order? Let's get two. Let's get 12. You know, it's a dry fried chicken wings. They will change your life.
TV or movie?
I could go smart, but I was going to go my favorite TV show
to
turn off my, yeah. just sort of like, it let all my problems go, and actually really I can stop thinking about like the racism and the isms, even though it has plenty of those in there, but it's just sort of, it's Shark Tank.
Shark Tank.
I will watch the shit out of some Shark Tank.
Hello, my name is Emily Johnson, this is my husband Robin, and these are our children Aaron, Lachlan, and Jake.
The kids' company is called Flipouts, and they are seeking a $100,000 investment in exchange for a 20% equity stake in the company.
It's a game show about the American dream. It's so
But it's kind of, I find it touching.
It is touching.
No, I find your reaction to it touching.
Oh, yeah.
That as somebody who feels betrayed by the American dream,
mm-hmm.
at the same time, you're watching that because it is the American
dream. It's people going in my basement. It's like, you know, it's like the moment of like they're selling something that is just like, I've invented a clip that you put on your backpack so that you can hang your iPad from it. Like, what? You're like, that's not a thing. And then they go, well, what made you inspire this? 3 years ago, my dad died of cancer. Oh. Like, it was just like... it's a great, like, my wife is just like, you know, it's like the thing I do when the kids are asleep. My wife's upstairs watching Girls on her iPad. I get mad when there's not new episodes of Shark Tank. Mm-hmm. It's my happy place.
Now you kids are seeing what life is really like, and this is an important lesson for you. In the end, it's only about the money all of the time. Never forget that. If you consider our original offer, take it or leave it.
What you gonna do?
We are so taking it.
We're taking it. Oh.
And finally, miscellaneous, anything from your life that you would recommend to others? And I'm looking for the first thing that pops into your mind.
That I'd recommend in my life from others.
To others from your life.
From my life. Oh.
You're looking up at the ceiling, and I know there's things darting through your mind, and I just want that first thing.
First class.
Yes. It took me a second to even understand what you were talking about.
That was the first thing I thought of. Like,
well, hell,
am I
going to
say that? I'm going to recommend first class.
Yes.
It's nicer at the front of the plane.
Oh.
You'll find out how shitty they're treating you in the back of the plane by how well you get treated in first class. And then if they're not treating you well in first class, you're like, oh my God, back there it must be like a war-torn third world country because it's not good up here. I have gotten to the point in my career where I insist I won't. It's not important to come. We're going to pay you $50 million, but we're going to fly you coach. I can't be there. I'm just like, I get angry. My assistant Seamus is outside, and he sent me some flights, and one of them had the word, I was like, don't send me flights with the word coach in them ever again. Like, it became very, like, diva, showbiz diva. I was like, first class. I'm not saying everybody can afford it. I luckily live in an industry where people pay for my flights a lot of times, but, like, I really like it. Just like it, just I travel a lot, and it makes a huge difference. And I know people sort of go, "What's the big deal up here?" It's a big deal.
I think there's no better way to end than on a Rosa Parks moment.
front of the plane.
W. Kamau Bell. The show is United Shades of America. The new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, Tales of a 6'4" African-American heterosexual cisgender left-leaning asthmatic black and proud blurred mama's boy dad and stand-up comedian. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here, and thank you for being amazing.
Thank you. This was truly great. I'm happy. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio in New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Robin Lynn with music composed by Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.